mission with the high seas. That's in a moment.
On BBC One.
You will repay your debt to society by working the number of hours mandated by the court.
Community service is about to get interesting.
It's not our money.
We found it. We're entitled to it.
What if it's drug money?
They're going to come looking for it. And he's going to have a name like Joey Pliers.
Starring Stephen Merchant and Christopher Walken.
So I suggest you find my money and whoever took it.
We're in community service, not Ocean's 11.
The Outlaws continues tonight at 9 on BBC One and iPlayer.
Nothing dodgy here on Radio 4 now, where it's opening time.
The Museum of Curiosity.
Hello, my name's John Lloyd, and I'm the Professor of Ignorance at Southampton Sonnet University. Welcome to the Museum of Curiosity, an immense attraction, infinite in space, but also in time, so that it offers not only fun for all the family, but for all the families that have ever lived or will ever live. It's quite a day out if you like people. And here with me is a people-partial person par excellence. It's the museum's curator, Holly Walsh.
Hello, John.
Oh, hello, Holly. Have you been working hard at the museum this week?
Of course, Professor.
Good.
I've been supervising a lot of school trips.
Great. And what are the most popular exhibits?
Well, the little ones like Sarah Millican's Pictures of Animals in Clothes, naturally. The middle schoolers go for Helen Scales' A Tank Full of Seahorses. And the big hit with sixth formers is Jimmy Carr's A Book Containing All the Jokes in the World.
Not surprised. And what about the teachers?
Yeah, they just can't tear themselves away from Greg Jenner's The 18th Amendment of the US Constitution.
Yeah, it's a fascinating piece of legislation.
Yeah, and it's hung right next to the bar.
Right.
So...
Well, cheers. Well, let's meet today's panel, who are the veritable Smith, Jones and Robinson of all steering committees. Film producer and novelist Elizabeth Robinson, comedian and Paralympics reporter Rosie Jones, and astronomer and impressionist John Culshaw, who's here in the guise of asteroid 3351 Smith. Hello.
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 Now, John, you're one of the country's finest impressionists and can be heard on Radio 4's Dead Ringers, which has run for over 20 series. But you've also presented The Sky at Night with Sir Patrick Moore, as well as appearing on Parkinson, Pointless Celebrities, and in Countdown's Dictionary Corner. Now, I gather that your personal audio library of impersonations now runs to more than 350 voices. Do you have any that you prefer to your own?
Oh, I think all of them, really, I think. there are certain ones that I go to by default that I probably find comforting. Alan Bennett is quite comforting.
Or perhaps Les Dawson, speaking in a very erudite manner until the punchline came along, which would hit you like a custard pie in the face. I've got such a habit of peppering the conversation with different voices. Whatever the subject might be, it might remind me of a certain person, and I'll just bring them in without realising it.
Do you find yourself mimicking when you're listening to the radio or watching the news or something like that?
Yes, usually that's how you discover new characters. I remember watching American Idol or The X Factor, and, you know, there was Cowell speaking in this very precise way. There was the choppy hand gesture, and there was, you know, this sort of arrogance in a fairly warm fashion, and those teeth, and I thought, there's a character, that's very good. And that's how you usually spot them. I remember seeing Hugh Edwards reading a news bulletin in this way, and immediately, quite as subconsciously, I turned at that same jaunty angle that he was and began copying what he was saying with that sense of importance. So, yes, in a former life, I was probably some sort of parrot, I suspect.
I must say, I cannot get enough of you. I've spent hours listening to you and watching you. And give us a burst of Boris and Donald Trump having a conversation.
Oh,
maybe.
Yes.
With Boris,
yes.
One does tend to not need quite so many words. Yes, distraction is a great tool of his, so he doesn't have to... say anything.
And I think the Donald, I think, you know, do you miss me yet? I'm very, very happy. I'm going to be doing a lot of work. I'm going to be president again because Sleepy Joe, this is just not good enough. I'm coming back. Do you miss me yet?
That's excellent.
So you've also got a terrific love for astronomy, haven't you? And you've presented The Sky at Night alongside Sir Patrick Moore for the programme's 50th anniversary. Did you do him when you were on the show?
Oh, I couldn't resist that. Had to do that. Well, the story started because the very first episode in 1957, in those days, the programmes were never recorded, but the script still existed. So they wanted to try and bring that to life. Mm. So Jane Fletcher, the producer at the time, asked if I would portray the 1957 version of Patrick Moore. Mm. And Patrick, who was about, I think, 82 at this time and still presenting the programme, he was asked what he thought about this. And he said, no, this will not do at all. It must not be degenerated into an episode of Monty Python. No. So I went along to Patrick Moore's house in Selsey, Farthings, and I took with me my copy of The Observer's Book of Astronomy, written by Patrick Moore, and I asked him to sign it. And he went, oh, right, so you have an interest in astronomy, do you? And I said,
tough,
oh, yes,
gig.
I watched an episode of The Sky at Night in 1976, and there you were, talking about lunar eclipses and pulsars and Comet Arend-Roland and how it was probably never going to return. Great shame, because it's a wonderful object. And we just got on. He softened, and he sort of... His attitude changed as if he'd been joined by a long-lost mischievous twin who he'd been reunited with. And we presented it together then.
Well, thank you, John. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Wherever you go, you can be sure of making a good impression. Or 350. Coming to you now, Elizabeth, you've been a Hollywood studio executive, an award-winning film producer, a screenwriter, a podcast producer, and a developmental book editor. Your credits include Braveheart and Last Orders, and Variety named you as one of the top 10 new producers to watch. If that wasn't enough, your debut novel, The True and Outstanding Adventures of the Hunt Sisters, was a New York Times bestseller and translated into 12 languages. I must ask you, with such an impressively wide range of experience, what are the principles that you've learned about the creative process?
If there are, I haven't learned enough. Because it's every time it feels like I have no idea how to do this. I remember when I was an executive and I wanted to be a writer, and I had lunch with Pat Conroy, who was a really beloved American author, and he said, every novel is a new beginning. And I really think that's true. And I think it applies to every medium I've worked in, whether it's a movie or a book or a podcast. I think the best work originates in some individual's heart and soul, and they need to communicate that. Even though dozens of movies are collaborative and are brilliant, I think most of them started with one person saying, I want to get this, and then they gather people around them to help them get it, as opposed to starting from commerce. I think that can be a mistake. Mm.
As I have cause to know, you are a brilliant editor. Editing, would you agree, Elizabeth, is an easier job than actually primary writing?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because I was thinking about why writers historically weren't treated very well in Hollywood. And yet, only the writer is a creative person in a movie. Everyone else is interpreting what the writer actually created out of whole cloth. So I think creativity is really lonely and really thrilling, but it's really lonely. Editing is reacting. And editing for me is easier because I can see in the thicket of ideas, there's the idea you're trying to get to. There's what has to happen first. That has more to do with craft, editing. Creating can happen in so many different ways. And I actually pulled a couple of poems that I love about creativity. You know, T.S. Eliot has an amazing poem about how even after writing for years and years and years, he still is lost again and again. And he's really aware that there's only the trying of whatever you're trying to do. Everything's been done before. It's been done better. That's what the poem is basically saying. And I think that writing is infinitely harder than editing.
I went to a really brilliant talk by Christopher Nolan, and he was talking about when he wrote Interstellar, and he wrote down the themes of the film, mm-hmm. but not anything to do with genre or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And he gave this paragraph of what mm-hmm. the film was going to capture.
Yeah.
He gave it to Hans Zimmer, the composer, and said, can you write me some music that goes with these themes? So Hans Zimmer wrote this piece of music, and then he played it back to himself while he was writing a lot. And so the film is obviously set in space and everything like that, but it could have been a Western, it could have been a war film.
I'm working on a sci-fi script for Columbia Pictures. This is a whole new world for me to explore, especially the best science fiction is philosophical and poetic in some way. Not that I can pull that off, but I'm given free rein pretty much. So I'm aiming for something that's thought-provoking, not just lots of explosions with crickets or something, whatever the aliens are.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much. Never mind the Hunt sisters. Thank you for joining us to share your own true and outstanding adventures. Over to you now, Rosie. You wrote and presented the Radio 4 series Box Ticker and your Channel 4 travel series Trip Hazard. You've also appeared on shows including QI, 8 out of 10 Cats, Comedy Central's Roast Battle, and you were the Tokyo correspondent for the last leg during the Paralympics this summer.
Yeah.
That must have been amazing.
I think it was a best experience of my life.
Wow.
The Paralympics for me is so special because I spent a lot of my life being the only disabled person in a space. So for every 4 years to go to a place where if you're able-bodied, you're the old one. You're the weird one. It's so great to be with my people. They didn't have any spectators. So in a lot of stadiums, I was the only idiot cheering along. I thought Paralympic GB would get really annoyed at me screaming along, but I think word got round that I was a Para-GB cheerleader. So everywhere we went, the athletes were like, yeah, you came for us.
That's so sweet.
So yeah, it was incredible.
You've recently released your debut children's book, The Amazing Edie Eckhart. So what is the most amazing thing about Edie?
So I think the most amazing thing about Edie is she got cerebral palsy like me. She's a person that I wanted to be growing up. She goes through life making friends, doing what she wants to do. She does not let her disability stand in her way. I was one of the first disabled people to go to my primary school. So first of all, I could get away with murder. But I got a teacher's aide with me one-on-one, and that was the making of me, and it really allowed me to reach my full potential. Whereas under the current government, somebody with my disability now in a mainstream school would probably had to share a teaching assistant with four 5 other disabled children. So I'm really sorry. That started as a funny anecdote.
Thank you so much. You've done such a lot in such a short space of time. Mm-hmm. I think you must be that northern powerhouse they keep going on about. Well, yet again, it's time to open the museum for donations. Madam Curator, have you prepared a fanfare for us?
Oh, man, I have gone to a lot of effort this week. I've got something simple yet classic with no room to go wrong. It's Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man.
Oh, excellent. Please go ahead.
I now declare the museum open for donations.
What? Whoa, hold on, hold on. That is the unmistakable timbre of the 1978 Mark II Transit, Holly.
Oh, I got confused. That was the fanfare for the common van. My apologies. John, what would you like to donate to the museum?
The donation I would like to make is the view from the surface of an alien planet. This has always fascinated me. What on earth would you see if you were standing on the surface of an alien world looking into that alien sky? Because I love looking at our own night sky. Every time you see the moon rise, every time you see the moon set, the sunrise, different phases of the moon, it's always different. It's always fascinating. It's always beautiful and you never tire of it. But just imagine looking at the vista of an alien sky where everything was completely, utterly different. To stand on the surface of the moon of Saturn, Titan, and watch the great ringed planet rise and just fill the sky, giving an eerie golden bronze light. Standing on the surface of Pluto, where the sun would be just a point of light and still bright enough to be able to make out the vista, but just the alien splendour of such sights, it's always stirred my imagination enormously.
Do you remember the first time you looked through a telescope?
I do. I was about 7 or 8 and I'd watched an episode of The Sky at Night. It was my dad's binoculars, actually. Mm. And I remember going into the back garden and simply looking up at the crescent moon and just seeing all the mountains, all the craters, the Terminator line where light meets dark, and all of that texture, all of that magnificent desolation that was described by the astronauts. There it was in my dad's binoculars.
You were keen on eclipses?
Oh, yes, I do love to chase solar eclipses. Wherever they occur in the world, I've seen 3 so far. And I think the link between solar eclipses and imagining what you would see on the surface of an alien world, a total solar eclipse gives us light on the planet Earth, which I think is the most alien that it can be from the surface of the Earth. When there is just a tiny little slither of the sun left visible, say 3%, that gives you a deeply weird monochrome twilight over the Earth, which is quite unlike anything else. Different to a storm, different to a regular twilight, different to the blue hour, as it's called, before sunrise and sunset. It's so deeply alien and deeply weird, ethereal, visceral. You know, hair on the back of the neck, it's spooky and it's desperately fascinating to watch. And it heralds in the totality of a total solar eclipse, where the sun's corona becomes visible and the red flecks of the solar prominences. And it's the finest sight in all of nature.
John, how do you think we should display these magnificent views in the museum?
Well, I think if we have some sort of biosphere where you can change the desktop theme across the dome from above, just to give us a sense of the different light, just create the great sense of alien splendour.
I should have said it as Professor Brian Cox. Yes, he speaks at this pace because at this level you can fill an episode of Wonders of the Universe across 1 hour with less stuff.
Whereas Patrick Moore spoke at this speed, and that's why The Sky at Night always lasted 20 minutes. Good night.
Well, thank you, John, for tantalising us, I should say mesmerising us, with these views of far-off worlds. Who knows, perhaps one day humanity will venture deep into the cosmos and dwell on alien soil. Although that will play merry hell with our horoscopes, mark my words.
Elizabeth, you're next. What exhibit would you like to donate to the museum?
I would like to donate the High Seas.
That's a huge exhibit.
The Earth is 70% ocean, and of the oceans, 50% are not claimed by any country. Once you get 200 miles from shore, you're in the high seas. One of the reasons I'm so fascinated is I've always actually been a little bit afraid of the ocean. It's so vast, it's so deep, what's down there? You know, watching Jaws at an impressionable age was probably part of what led me to be a little bit afraid of the ocean. But the deep sea is the planet's life support. And obviously, we've heard all about how it's in danger. But in my research for this screenplay that I'm writing for Columbia, I have been reading a lot about how we divided up the oceans. And I was really moved by this concept called the common heritage of humanity, which was an ethical principle that applies to the deep sea bed and the high seas and outer space. So there's this wonderful utopic ideal. Unfortunately, my country has not ratified it, but, you know, neither did North Korea. So, you know, we're in good company. But the idea of this UN treaty that protects the seabed from exploitation is so utopic that it moves me. And it's rooted in this idea of the common heritage of humanity. Yet, right now, there's rampant criminality in the high seas. And so I think we should protect it because the deep sea is so crucial to the whole planet's health. And as much as I love looking at the stars, and no disrespect intended, John, I feel like, wow, we have only explored 5% of the ocean.
Mm. Have you been deep in the sea yourself? Have you been in a submarine?
No. I'm kind of terrified of the deep sea. I've gotten over it by reading all about it. And the bioluminescent creatures down there are amazing. Again, someone said if aliens came here, they wouldn't even bother with the land. They would go right down there because what those creatures look like and what they can do and how they can live with no light. And it's like they look like aliens. And
there are stories of unidentified submerged objects as well as UFOs. They are reported under the sea as well. Maybe that's going on. Who knows?
It's such a vast thing. You know, if Mount Everest was stood on the bottom of the Marianas Trench, there'd be more than a mile of water above it. It's like, it's unimaginably big. And I always think the sea is a metaphor for how life is, because is it one thing or many things? It's both one, the ocean, the high seas, if you like, is one enormous thing. There's only one ocean in the world. They're all connected. And yet it's composed of tiny little molecules, invisibly small molecules. And it's a bit like a metaphor for humanity. We're all individual people, but we're really one thing, humanity. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, thank you for your enormous gift of the high seas. Wherever we manage to find space to exhibit them, unlike some people I could mention, we'll really properly look after them.
Thank you.
So, Rosie, we've done outer space, we've done the high seas. What would you like to donate to the museum?
Well, I'm free your life. We've had two very, very big donations. So, I'm going to go itty-bitty and I'm going to donate the mission piece of the jigsaw. I love a jigsaw puzzle because my job is so busy and I'm there, here, everywhere. So when I got a day off, I really want to turn off and relax. And doing 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, I can do it in a day. And it's that lovely combination of your thinking, but it's not taxing. And at the end of a day, you have something to show for it.
Nice.
And yeah, doing 1,000-piece jigsaw on a rare day off is my happy place.
Wow. Oh, it's so lovely.
How often when you are doing your jigsaws, is there a missing piece? Is this a very common occurrence?
I've only had it one time. And I'm not exaggerating. It's up there with one of the worst moments of my life. You pour out your heart and soul. You're in there every minute getting it done. And one time a few years ago, my mum went to Milan and came back with a jigsaw puzzle of the Last Supper. So we spent weeks doing this puzzle, and we got to the end, and there was a piece missing. But the really weird part of it was the missing piece was a piece containing the face of Jesus.
Oh, wow.
We were devastated and we looked everywhere. And a week later, we found it stuck on the chair leg. But to this day, I swear on my life that it wasn't there. Oof. When we were looking.
Oh, that's extraordinary. My God.
I'm not a religious person, but I lost Jesus and I found him.
That's so good. That reminds me of, there's some quite good memes going around during lockdown, and one of them is a picture of the Last Supper, and the caption is, "A table for 26, please." And the waiter says, "But there's only 13 of you." And he says, "Yes, but we're going to sit on one side of the table." Well, thank you, Rosie, for solving one of life's enduring puzzles and finding that missing piece. A mystery wrapped in an enigma hidden down a back of a sofa. So, there we have it. The museum now has a huge amount of salt water that nobody owns, some vast alien vistas nobody has ever seen, and the small piece of cardboard nobody can ever find. I'd like to thank John, Elizabeth and Rosie. And speaking of nobody, I leave you with this from American football player Joe Theismann. Nobody in football should be called a genius. A genius is a guy like Norman Einstein. That's all from the museum this time. Goodbye.
The Museum of Curiosity was curated by John Lloyd and me, Holly Walsh. The donors were John Coulshaw, Rosie Jones and Elizabeth Robinson. The exhibits were catalogued by Mike Shepherd, Mike Turner and Mandy Fenton and Lydia Meisen of QI. The producer was Anne Miller and it was a BBC Studios production.
Next week, Griffith Jones, Mary Roach and Lem Sisse. So, how did Paul McCartney write some of the most famous songs released by the Beatles? Stay with us at 7:15 and he'll tell you.